53rd episode of Reverse Threat Radio. I'm Andy Ryan.
And I'm David Chad.
And as England touched down in Australia, we wonder who had to spend 23 hours sitting next to Stuart Broad.
A few episodes ago, Andy talked us through David Boone's exploits on a flight from Australia to England that involved several, I think we can say, pints of beer.
I mean, I think that's a very generous definition of several.
But I reckon personally that that's probably what you need to get through spending the better part of 24 hours.
I think with no Flintoff on the plane, it's hard to believe that any of the England players would have come to the party in terms
exactly.
of that challenge.
Exactly. So Ashes fever is just about to kick off. But we have been more interested in things happening on the other side of the world, haven't we?
Well, this morning, Pakistan were condemned to a pretty comprehensive hammering in the second test against South Africa, an innings and 92 runs. But let's not forget how extraordinary they were in the first test. For a team that had just lost to Zimbabwe, they outclassed South Africa, the world number one. And for me, I found myself really earnestly cheering this Pakistan side on. There were so many wonderful things about it. The improbable Mohammad Irfan, 7'1", possibly the tallest bowler ever to play test cricket. The ball he bowled to Alvaro Peterson is possibly the greatest rip snorter I've ever seen. I mean, it literally just launched off the pitch. What about young Kuram Manzoor, the opener, with 100 already secured, responded to Dale Steyn throwing the ball at him by blowing him kisses, which shows an arrogance of a young opener to do that for the greatest bowler in the world that I think we can all respect. And then there's Misbah-ul Haq, who I just feel is like the kind of long-suffering father of a chaotic family, always sweeping up the mess left by his reckless kids. Somehow, in this test, he found himself arriving twice at the crease after a mini-collapse. Even in the second innings, when they needed just 45 to win, he came in on something like 7-3. And both times, he coolly saves the situation, as he always seems to do.
And so, it's always a temptation with Pakistan to use the word mercurial. As you're saying, in the first test, they sort of pulled it out of the bag a bit, and all of these performances came together. And as you also said, they have just been pretty roundly thrashed. How has that changed your newfound love for Pakistani cricket?
Well, I think it's meant that it's far better to be a kind of have Pakistan as a second team rather than a first team. I think there was a wonderful tweet.
Brilliant. I'm glad. I think they'll be glad to hear that actually. They're good as a kind of B-string support.
There was a wonderful. I think if you fully supported them, if they were your only solace in cricket, I think you'd go crazy. There was a wonderful tweet by Nishant Joshi, our friend from Alternative Cricket, who said, "I feel like the same about supporting Pakistan as I do about heroin. I'd like to try it, but I'm too scared." And I think that's kind of fair. I don't feel similarly about heroin, just to clarify. But the amazing thing about this first is that Pakistan didn't wear sides down. They don't seem to wear sides down. If they are going to play well, they blow them away. Mm. And I think that was what was so fun to watch about that first test.
Interesting. Yeah, I mean, my eye was caught by it as well, actually. And by this, obviously, the big story at the moment, which is Faf du Plessis and the ball tampering, supposedly having, although he's now confessed to it. I wasn't going to say his crotch. I was simply going to say the zip on his trousers that he was, which actually I thought was quite an innovative way. You know, Atherton did the dirt. He's got the zip. You know, we all have our different ways of tampering with the ball. But what I thought was sort of particularly depressing about the story was the fact that watching it unfold in the media, you know, the initial allegations came out, or at least the umpires fined the South Africans 5 runs. Mm. And then the South African team absolutely came out in arms about this. De Villiers, who's captain in this test, said simply, "We are not a team that scratches the ball." Another teammate, who I forget exactly who it is, just said, "Faf's one of my best friends, and he's the last person alive who would do such a thing." And then the next morning, he comes out and confesses it, which in and of itself for me is actually quite a worrying thing, that there's a kind of division in the team.
I suppose
that there are people who, because they would not, the players, his teammates would not come out and have defended him if they knew that the next morning they were going to be shown to be complete idiots and he was going to come out and defend
him. Does it show, I guess, that he acted independently, perhaps? I mean, I suppose it's the gut reaction of players, I guess, in any sport, that you instinctively come to the defence of your teammate. But I wonder what's maybe as interesting about it is it seems that perhaps there wasn't a great conspiracy around this. Maybe it was just his own initiative.
Yeah. But I wonder at the same time, you know, when we think about, and I know it's a completely different world, but when we think about Pakistan and the troubles that they have had with match fixing, that seems to come out of a certain anarchy within the team that doesn't really have a centralised leadership that everyone follows, and this seems to be the same kind of thing. So that's what's been happening in the Test arena. What else caught your eye over the last fortnight?
Well, I've been slightly alarmed by this story coming out of India, and it's a story of censorship. It came out on Cricket Info that a number of commentators employed by the connected to the BCCI have basically been informed very clearly about what they are and aren't allowed to talk about. And just to clarify, this does not concern, for example, the Sky feed that would ever come from India. This concerns,
and it doesn't concern Reverse White Radio. We are a free voice.
Well, I don't know.
And we are not being censored. Maybe
I don't know. If we went to Mumbai, would we be able to broadcast this freely? These, you know, pinpoint opinions. Would we be able to unleash them? I don't know. But the BCCI rather unusually retain control over this world feed, which is broadcast to a lot of the rest of the world. And some of these stories, and obviously all these commentators speaking anonymously, talk of these tales of almost a kind of atmosphere of fear, everyone looking over their shoulder. Things like, for example, Indian selection policy being something that was considered beyond discussion. And there have been a lot of stories coming out of cricket in the last few years about kind of India using its influence in not necessarily the best ways. But for me, this is one of the most alarming, actually. The idea that you would be so paranoid as a cricketing authority to deny commentators the right to say what they think, I think is a really alarming picture.
I mean, the idea of a free press is something that we have, you know, we're completely used to and is sort of at the forefront of everything that we do, not just in a sporting world, but in a sort of social world as well.
You almost don't think censorship of cricket commentators is almost kind of beyond comprehension. You think, well, why? Why would you censor them?
One last thing just on the subject of sort of commentary and the like. I was watching on Sky Sports the other day, they were doing a feature on Sachin Tendulkar and they were doing his three best hundreds. And actually it was so dull that I stopped watching halfway through, and it just came into mind that something that's been a kind of constant bugbear of mine is that most cricket highlight packages are absolutely awful, because actually watching a succession of fours, sixes and wickets tells you nothing about what has happened in a day. It simply tells you about individual games.
I think it's particularly bad, actually, for showing the quality of an individual innings.
It is.
Because
you get no sense of continuity.
No, quite. And a lot of great innings are often crafted, you know, there'll be the odd difficult over, that actually seeing that tells you as much about the greatness of the innings as seeing the odd
Exactly. And so my idea, very briefly, is that actually the way that the cricket highlights should be run is actually that it should be someone introducing a day's play and taking you through the story of the day and telling you about the ebbs and flows and using the footage as a way of illustrating that, rather than just using it as a montage of four, sixes and wickets.
From the archives, and since we were last on air, Toby's been on a Middle Eastern adventure, and amidst the deserts and oases, he rather improbably found some cricket.
So a couple of weeks ago, I headed off to Oman with a couple of friends, driving around, seeing the sights, seeing some of the fortresses, travelling up into the mountains, and as Andy said, very unexpectedly, stumbled across a game of cricket. We were in the seaside town of Sirte that, frankly, it doesn't have much going for it apart from being absolutely bakingly
hot. It's got a beach.
It's got a beach of sorts. It's got a lot of dhow factories. And we were, in fact, looking at some of these. So dhows are these boats that they used to sail around into the China Sea. And we were sort of mooching around one morning.
Looking for a potential
purchase.
It was
sort of 40 plus degrees heat. It was extraordinarily hot. I mean, the kind of heat in which you're constantly looking for shade. And we were sort of just driving along, and I suddenly saw this open patch of ground, and on it was what looked like a game of cricket. And indeed, it was a game of cricket. And so we went around and we stopped there, and it turned out that it was two teams playing in a sort of local league there at the time. And it was sort of one of the most unlikely settings that I've ever seen for a game of cricket, really. So there was not a blade of grass anywhere on the entire pitch. The pitch itself was made out of concrete with the most enormous cracks. You know, when we go and play a test match up at Headingley, we sort of, you know, look in detail at the pitch and poke our keys down into the... I mean, these were cracks that were I'm not exaggerating, were kind of 3 inches wide. That if you had, you would get considerable movement, I think, is what you had to say from that. And they were playing a 12-over game. And I mean, it was just fascinating actually, because suddenly, in a you do not really associate. I suppose you do a bit more now with Pakistan playing over in the Middle East, but you don't really associate cricket in the Middle East. And it was just something that I suddenly stumbled on. And actually, one of the things that struck me most was that I got chatting to the coach of the side that was batting. It was quite an important match. It was a semi-final of some tournaments. And what struck me straight away was just the fact that all of the kind of considerations that I have when I play for my kind of club team up in near Cambridgeshire, in the middle of nowhere, were exactly the same. So he was saying, yeah, the problem was that the last time we were playing, it was raining and the ball was swinging all over the place. And this kind of, and you suddenly kind of think, hang on, it's 40-something degrees heat. What on earth is going on here? So, I mean, I just thought it was an interesting kind of spectacle that we came across.
And it's interesting because a lot of people, both who know the game very well and even people who are quite new to it, often think, well, one of the defining things about cricket is, God, it's so hard to find the right sort of pitch, the right conditions.
Exactly.
It's such a hassle to play a game of cricket. And that actually shows you that a lot of times it's really about enterprise. It's about, fine, we'll play it on a concrete wicket. We don't have any pads. We don't have a proper ball, but we'll still make a game of it.
Yeah. And actually, the interesting thing was just seeing how versatile cricket is. Because for exactly all those reasons that you say, but also, you know, there was a football goal, a sort of square leg, and they developed a rule about what happened if it hit there. And actually, there was, the fielding was amazing, really, really good fielding, but it was all based around a technique whereby, because the ground was so hard, basically, if you went down on the ground, you would just, you cut yourself all over the place and you get massive bruises and scratches because it was just playing on baked mud, basically. And so they developed a style of fielding that was really, really effective, but involved no part of the body ever being in contact with the ground, even kind of bizarrely when diving almost.
And it takes to its extreme the idea that cricket's always been about adapting to conditions, hasn't it?
Yep.
Whether it is, as you sort of said, cloud and cracks at Headingley, or whether it's 40-degree heat and a rock-solid ground in Oman, that's always been part of the game.
Interesting. So the day after we saw this game was actually the day that Sachin Tendulkar retired, or rather announced his retirement, and I wasn't kind of on the internet or anything, so I wasn't seeing it through the internet, but actually I heard all about it through the newspapers in Oman, that there was a 4-page spread in the back of the English-speaking daily that was all about Sachin Tendulkar. And actually, sort of on the back of this, I was sort of putting two and two together, and obviously there's quite a sort of vibrant cricket culture that goes on there. And I went and had a look at, once I came back, at how this kind of how this has come about. And a lot of it is actually because a fairly significant proportion of the population are migrants from the subcontinent, particularly from India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh, who have come across. And actually, I suppose that when the migrant community, one of the ways of continuing that community and kind of building that community is by having things like cricket games. So actually, one of the interesting things was that in this game that we saw, it was that there wasn't an Arab in sight, actually, and it was all migrant population who were playing. But it was migrant populations from both ends of Oman that had come together to play. So actually, it was a really kind of community-based
It's really interesting, actually, when cricket is something that migrant communities often refuse to give up. I mean, it's very well documented in the US, actually, that cricket in the US is really built entirely off the back of migrants from the subcontinent and migrants from the West Indies, who brought the game there and just refused to give it up.
Yeah. And similarly, I suppose, cricket is the old saying that cricket was spread by the empire. And absolutely, the British Empire had slightly more sinister reasons than just wanting a reminder of home. But as much as anything, cricket is a great kind of community builder. As much as anything else, I mean, I suppose the flip side of that is exactly as I said, there was not an Arab in sight, an Omani in sight during this game, and actually, it was very much kind of, I don't know if ghettoised is the right word.
But it wasn't something that was
getting out into the wider community. It was very much the held by the migrant populations.
And I suppose it's a personal judgment, really, whether that's seen as a problem or not, really. I mean, is it okay for a migrant community to have their own sport, have their own thing, or do you kind of want it to become a unifier? And I guess you'd hope maybe over time local people within the country might take it up, but it's not necessarily a criticism of the pursuit that they don't.
Oh, no, not at all. And I think it's exactly as you say. It's kind of, in a sense, it's early days for Omani cricket. They are an associate nation of some description. The ICC kind of associate structure confuses me thoroughly.
Yeah.
But they are an ICC.
The ICC knows that cricket is happening there.
Exactly. To the review, in this episode we are looking at Sujit Mukherjee's autobiography of an unknown cricketer.
Mukherjee, who died in 2003, was an Indian academic who went on to become a renowned publisher. Aside from this, he wrote several books on cricket, was an occasional commentator and a talented amateur.
So the premise behind this book is that after his first book, which was titled Playing for India, someone wrote to him and said, "You have never played for India. What's your qualification? Either to write a book called Playing for India or to write about cricket, full stop." And in the pretext, as it's called, to this novel, he says this: "Partly provoked by that reviewer, partly to exercise a fundamental right, I decided to write a book that was all about my own cricket. No cricket one has watched or read about can ultimately be as memorable as the cricket one has played oneself, no matter at what level." So clearly he thinks his own cricketing life is interesting. Did you think it was interesting as well?
I'd been desperately looking forward to reading this book because I'm an avid collector of all the kind of top 10, top 50 cricket book lists.
That makes you sound really cool, by the way.
It does. I mean, I don't think much of what I say on Reverse Radio makes you sound particularly cool. But Autobiography of an Unknown Cricketer puts in an appearance on lots of these lists. And I'll be honest when I say that it didn't really live up to my expectations. It's not that I have a problem reading about obscure games. I actually feel like many of the best cricket books I read, and I hate coming back to them again and again and again, but you know, some of Duncan Hamilton in The Last English Summer, you know, there's nothing wrong with writing about obscure games, but I feel like if you write about games that are not instinctively of great interest to your reader, you have to make the match reports compelling, you've got to bring up big ideas, you've got to bring up big characters. I personally didn't feel Mukherjee did that, and a lot of the games I was reading about, I had a bit of a so what feeling about.
So just to go back to the kind of synopsis of the book, it's I mean, you know, as that original pretext says, it's the story of his life in cricket essentially, and he is, as you said in your little introduction, he's an academic. He was a school teacher for a long time. He was at school. He stayed around at the school in various capacities, and then became a writer afterwards. And has sort of been playing on an amateur basis, but also been administrating cricket throughout his life. And actually, I agree with you about the match reports. And very often, the match reports were obviously things that were significant to him because they were a team that he was coaching or a team that he had supported in some way or even a team that had an impact on how his team was going to work. So a match on the other side of India. And I agree with you in terms of the match reports. But where I don't think I agree with you is that actually I think the book is interesting on two fronts, one of which is it does have some sort of quite interesting human stories in it. So quite close to the beginning, there's the story of the a chap called Father Cleary, who is the who is a sort of remnant of imperialism and has sort of stayed over, you know, for the last days of the Raj, and is still there and is teaching cricket, and he's a kind of larger than life character. And I thought that was a really, really interesting sort of character sketch, and it actually was quite an interesting sketch related to cricket as well, and the way that cricket was embedded into the establishment there, and then going forward there.
I would actually agree with that, but I think the book would be better for a lot more characters like that. And I think, you know, we think about a lot of the cricket books we've enjoyed. I think back to that, you know, Cricket with the Penguins book and stuff, and so much of that is about
Penguins Stop Play.
Brilliant book. And so much of that book, I mean, all the cricket in that is totally obscure village cricket. You bring these big, larger than life characters out, and that's what makes them. And I don't think this book does it quite enough.
So the other thing that really interested me, and it'd be interesting to see what you think of this actually, is that I was quite interested in the bits that sort of talked about the business of cricket. So the bits that talked about setting up a league, because actually Mukherjee was quite involved in the way that the school leagues and actually the sort of lower level professional leagues were developing on a regional level in India. And I thought it was absolutely fascinating, some of the things that he was talking about in the way that you run those leagues and the different considerations for the teams that were coming through.
Yeah,
what do you think of those?
Well,
parts?
I think that's a good example of where the book covered material that is I've not seen covered elsewhere, actually. And I would agree with you. I think that is interesting. And I think it's a the life of a cricket administrator is something that we're all very opinionated on. But especially like a lower league administrator is something that we've... And yeah, I think that was interesting. I just think, again, like a lot of the book, it was perhaps... And maybe this is inevitable. When you write about yourself, you don't always understand the fact that what you find fascinating is not fascinating to everyone else. And I think occasionally, he just needs to bring out these bigger ideas, these bigger themes that will be relevant to, you know, a reader in 21st century England.
And you think that it should be him... bringing them out rather than the reader kind of making the connection. I mean, sorry, that's a horribly kind of big philosophical question about the nature of authorship.
Well, I'd be very curious to know. I mean, I wonder to what extent this book's popularity is founded on the fact that I imagine for a lot of Indian cricket fans, this must be a fascinating nostalgia trip through a period of Indian cricket that I assume, you know, in the same way that our English game has moved on, I'm sure Indian cricket has moved on as well. I would be curious to know how many international fans feel they could relate to this book. I don't want to be overcritical. There were lots of parts I enjoyed. I enjoyed his rise as a cricket journalist. I liked the kind of element of entrepreneur to it. You know, you write to all these different magazines, you carve out, you get a bit of luck here. You know? And I think that's a really interesting story. And I personally find it a far more interesting story than this kind of these stories of unmitigated success, you know. Oh, suddenly I was, you know, commentating on Sky for, you know, £250,000 a year.
I think this is one of the interesting things about the book, which is also makes it kind of slightly unstable almost structurally, is the fact that you have this story of him becoming a cricket journalist, so the kind of autobiographical elements, and then the autobiographical elements of him and his cricket career, which was not sort of insignificant. He seems to be in a pretty good amateur cricketer. But then you also have these questions about the development of cricket tournaments in India and all of these things. And it seems as if he's kind of trying to shove everything into the same book. And it's, apologies, we set ourselves a time limit and we've briefly gone over it. But just to wrap up, I think one of the, where I will agree with you is that there is a kind of structural failure in trying to get too much into it. But I certainly think that there are anecdotes and that there are parts of it that are really of interest.
To the interview, and this episode I spoke to Australian cricket blogger Ian Reid, founder of the Baggy Green blog. So it seems strange to be talking about it still, given that it already seems like a long time ago, but there was huge anticipation ahead of this summer's Ashes series, and the general feeling both among cricket fans and just sort of the English media as a whole was that it was a bit of an anticlimax. It never took off in the way 2005 did, and even really the way 2009 did, sorry. Is that your feeling, that it was a bit of an anticlimax of a series?
Well, look, the cricket was pretty good. It wasn't great, but it was good. And I have to say, I think I would be agreeing with you that there was a bit of an anticlimax. I don't think that's just with English supporters. I think Australian supporters felt exactly the same way. And I think if you look back at the first test, you know, really went to the end of the match with Brad Haddon being caught behind of the bowling of Anderson. And I think, you know, there were just different passages during that test. It was a really good test. And I think for a lot of people, that was maybe setting the tone for the series. And then, of course, when Lords came around, we got thumped. And the whole dynamic changed, because then also there was the controversy of the DRS, which I think put a bit of a bleak, you know, atmosphere over the rest of the Ashes series. And then there were liars. So I think it dipped.
You made a really good point in that the Trent Bridge test deserves to stand alongside kind of any of the 2005 tests. And I remember watching that, and you really thought, and maybe it just built expectations kind of too high. But because it's one of the things that I find a bit strange is that a lot of people have written this series off. But then that test was great. The test up at Durham, again, was sort of thrilling. So, I mean, has there been a very similar response in Australia as a whole? Did people get as into it as previous Ashes series? Or is that, you know, did it clearly feel like less of an event?
After that Lord's test, I think it just sunk. You know, obviously seeing the first, although, you know, there were a few saving graces with both sides. in terms of the players who stood up at different intervals with test, you know, with England really just coming out on top and sort of stealing them. A lot of people, the vibe I picked up is that a lot of people sort of just lost a little bit of interest along the way, and too few people were really supporting the team, which is what you really need to do when those sort of lows happen. So I think it's a valid point that you made there.
Yeah, I there was a very interesting point you made on your blog, which you talked about the fact that England kind of won the key moments. And because I think several people have said this, but it didn't feel like, a lot of the time watching the cricket, it didn't feel like the hammering that the final scoreline suggested. I mean, there was obviously great examples of like Manchester and Durham, where Australia were well on top actually for huge stages, and obviously actually the Oval, and then came away with nothing. What do you put that down to? That fact that those key passages, was it home advantage? Was it experience? What do you think was the kind of key determinant there?
I felt that it was important to sort of stress that point. I'm glad you came across it because Ian Bell, that was the difference.
He was just
unbelievably consistent. And with batting being our weakness, he really just showed that level of consistency was what was required just to sort of separate the sides. So in a lot of regards, I just felt that he really deserved quite a bit of respect at the end of the series. But as a whole, I would have to say, Andy, England as a team, they've experienced the winning feeling a lot more. They've had that winning edge. More personalities have been involved in those wins, whereas for Australia, it's been pretty bleak times for the last while. And while there's been positives, at the end of the Ashes, like you said, the scoreline didn't suggest that it was really a hammering because there were a lot of positives to take away. As a group, England just have that edge. They've got that experience in winning those key moments. And if you look back at it, even going back to 2009, Australia were better as individual cricketers, but as a whole, England had greater synergy. Mm. And, at the elite level, that makes a difference.
I think there are a lot of parallels, actually, between 2009, because I think you could almost say exactly the same thing about 2009, that actually Australia played better cricket for huge swathes and England still somehow won the series. I mean, you made this point just now about it has been a difficult time for the Australian side. You came out of a very difficult, there had actually been some quite good successes really against South Africa, then a really difficult series against India, then and then all the problems in the camp. Do you think at the moment we're looking at an Australian team just going through a dip and a rebuilding phase? Or are there more serious problems? Because I have read articles to do with, the attraction of Aussie rules, football and all these things. Is that an overreaction or is there a serious problem or is this just a dip?
I think when things are going through a bit of a low patch, people are going to pick up on all the different dynamics. And that could be, social aspects that maybe affect the game. Other sports that are maybe rivaling Cricket Australia's efforts to make cricket the number one sport. And obviously when a team's not doing well, that criticism or those observations are just going to go through the roof. But there are problems, mate. You can't sort of beat about the bush there, and it does start at the top of the food chain, but that's a whole different topic. If we were to talk about that, it'll be a whole different story. But in terms of the actual dynamics, I knew the rebuilding would be tough, and it's not an overnight thing. But the previous selection panel, under the Hilditch regime, they were pretty much to blame for a lot of things, with the way, green caps were handed out like candy to a kid, And it just, that sort of culture was breaking down constantly, and there was a lot of inconsistency with the selection policies. And then, they were disregarding experienced players. Simon Kadich is always, my number one example that's used. Brad Hodge was a guy who was still on the side, ready to give his best. They didn't use the experience. They were bringing in young guys who just weren't ready. They had the ability, but they weren't ready to step up. So there was just this schism there. And when I look at the situation now, the new panels had a lot of mess to clean up. So although there are problems, and I said that's a whole different topic of debate, I should just say yes, there's a rebuilding going on, which has taken a bit longer than expected. And this is the Australian team. It will come around eventually.
Well, I think, because that's my
feeling on it is that I think, because I kind of got into cricket first, sort of in, obviously in the 90s, when everyone was saying very similar things about England, how, you know, England will never be a world force again. And similarly, yeah, there were fundamental problems in England with the county game, et cetera, et cetera. But I thought it was really interesting you focused in on selection, because actually, a lot of the England players, who even some of the decent England players from the 90s, they look back on it and say, you know, yeah, you were just in and out of the squad. You know, one bad test, you're in and out. And I wonder, that consistency of selection seems like a huge issue.
Yeah, I remember watching the Ashes, and I think it was David Lloyd who brought up the point when they were having those sort of fierce comparisons between the English team of the 90s. So I'm actually going to agree with you on this one, that I think those sort of comparisons are pretty valid.
Okay, no, and it's
funny. Selection does play a role.
Yeah, and it seems like a lesson that almost all national boards end up having to learn. So another feature of this most recent Ashes series is there did seem to be a growing animosity between the two teams. You had the Stuart Broad incident, you had Darren Lehman's comments, you had this kind of little run-in between Michael Clarke and Kevin Peterson. I wondered if you saw that from an Australian perspective, there was a bit more aggro, and also whether you think that that's a good or bad thing for the Ashes going forward.
Yeah, I think it's going to depend how much, you know, alcohol the fans are going to consume this summer.
Yeah.
You know, with such a quick turnaround in the series, I think a lot of the incidents are still going to be, you know, fresh in a lot of fanatics' minds. But I believe that it was more frustration with the actual officiating. Mm. DRS wasn't used very well. The umpiring standards were pretty awful.
They were, weren't they? Yeah.
Yeah. Then there was the light issues as well. And like I said to you before we started chatting, I don't really want to go down the road of the Stuart Broad incident, because, you know, it would be hypocritical of me to start, you know, trash talking him when I don't really think the blame was on him. But a lot of the animosity was more in an officiating perspective. And I think with players, you know, fighting for confidence, fighting for their own performances. And the bitterness of, you know, how that Stuart Broad incident did have a bit of an effect on the outcome of that match.
Yeah, yeah.
There was a little bit of emotions. I think it's just like any series, the Ashes, you know, we've both watched loads of series, and the emotions just tend to sort of boil towards the end. And I think if it doesn't cross the line too much, it's going to be really good. You know, controversy is always good for the game. It sparks the viewers. It adds to the drama. It's good to have people heated with their views, and it's good to have constructive debates. But hopefully it'll stay as clean as it could be. But good luck to Stuart Broad when he enters Australia.
Yeah, I think you made a great point, though, because I think the officials created a lot of the tension. And, I mean, I think Stuart Broad is a fascinating example, though, in that, you know, compared to someone like Flintoff, who I'm just, you know, I get the impression from the Australians I know and have spoken to, Flintoff was a figure who the Australians respected. You know, he was, this is my reading on it. Whereas Stuart Broad, for all his ability, just his kind of, his like petulance, his kind of schoolboy thing does just seem to really wind up a lot of the Australians, which I can totally see from the way he behaves. I guess, so moving on a little bit from the Ashes, and I wonder if we could talk a little bit about sort of your cricket writing and your work. I think you made a really interesting point in your blog where you said that actually in the future you're thinking you're going to focus your efforts a lot more on Twitter and Facebook rather than the Baggy Green blog. And I just wondered if you could explain a little bit of the reasoning behind that.
It's just the longer that England have to earn, the deeper my depression becomes. I have writer's block. I've been doing this now for 5 years plus, and I did it because I identified that the team was going to be going through a bit of a dip, and I wanted to be quite vocal in my support for the team and just connect with like-minded supporters who would be able to, you know, talk constructively about cricket, analytically about cricket. And it's been great because I've made some really good friends over the years in different countries. I mean, I was in England last year and I met Kirby. She writes at another site called Thoughts from the Dustbin. She's quite active out there. I was, you know, it was good to meet her, you know, after, you know, 4 years of chatting. You know, like also this series, my one mate from New Zealand, Sylvester, he does quite a bit of work with me at the blog. He's coming over to Adelaide to watch the test with me, along with my other mate Dan from Sydney. So for the first time, you know, the three of us are going to be together. So I think I look at the connections I've made, and that's good. But we write these articles and put a lot of effort into, a lot of energy, and you don't really get the feedback, you know, through the, as it's been at the Green Blog, more interaction and connection to supporters you know, through social media platforms such as Facebook and Twitter. So it's more just a case of that's where guys are at now, that's where the attention is at. And you know, I recently wrote a little Satchington article. It's not like I'm discarding it. I may just need to change the way I deliver my content, but you know, at least through those social avenues, I can still chat to guys, and why I did it.
I think it's a really interesting distinction, actually, because if you put the articles up on the blog, it's kind of, I mean, lots of cricket blogs, including yours, that I go to regularly, and it's a great resource. And, you know, personally, I go to them, frankly, more than I go to the standard English newspaper cricket pages. But it's kind of the fact that I can see exactly what you mean by interaction, because you kind of put it up there, and you're not really sure. Lots of people will read it and then won't interact. Whereas it is quite funny that the ability sort of during a game to be on Twitter interacting with people all over the world, it is a lot of fun. I can see where that feeling of community is really nice. I mean, in terms of other cricket writers out there, bloggers or journalists, who do you really rate highly? Because I guess as a podcast, we're always really interested to get recommendations.
I know that you spoken with John Houghton at the Old Bats?
Yes, we have.
He wrote a particular piece on Philip Hughes a while ago that I really enjoyed. I quite like his work quite a lot. But if I was talking about writers I follow closely, it would certainly be a guy like Brian Coverdale of ESPN Cricket. So, I actually met him 2 years ago, and I find a lot of I draw a lot of comparisons with my writing to his work and get quite a bit of inspiration from that, because he writes quite analytically. He's got a very simplistic delivery, which kind of makes his articles resonate a bit better with reasons or well, with readers, I guess, on kind of a logical basis. But he tackles issues quite neutrally. So I just like that way he gets his point across, and you know, to see how his writing's improved over the years, it's really good. So I'd have to say him as someone whose work I really enjoy.
Okay, that's really interesting. He's definitely someone I've got to know a little bit through Crick Info, but I should make more of an effort actually to keep up with his stuff. Final question, one that we try and ask everyone who comes on the show. If you were in charge of the ICC, or you know, you're in charge of world cricket, what's day one? What's top of the to-do list? What needs to be changed?
Just one thing. look, I think just before I quickly answer that, the ICC is doing a great job. And a lot of the things they do a good job on is kind of not under the spotlight. So, you know, the way they're really pushing women's cricket, I think, is absolutely awesome. I'm all for that. And I know they've pumped quite a lot of money into the game in other countries too, which, again, is just important, you know, because, you know, for all of us, you know, as cricket lovers, that's important. But having heard a bit about the review system now, that's something that needs to be sorted. It's not a new system. That was implemented in 2009. There's been plenty of time to iron out the issues now, and especially after the last series. I know that now made like a few changes, like you get a review top-up voucher, so to speak, after 80 overs or something. I mean, that's not going to solve the issue. They need to really look into it. You know, the third umpire must be brought into the game far more now. The resources must be used better. And also this ball half-hitting the wicket nonsense, that's also got to stop. You know, LBW is... Were you hit in front of the stumps, would the ball have hit the wicket? Not about, would it, you know, one third of the ball have just tipped the left stump? You know, I get their basis, but, yeah, and at the same time, players need to show more responsibility when using it. You know, I don't think Michael Clarke used it particularly well during the Ashes.
On the 14th of November, all being well, Sachin Tendulkar, the man who has scored more test runs than any other player in the history of the game, will play his 200th and final test match. For the debate, we're asking, did Sachin time his retirement well?
A big question for me is exactly who has been sort of party to this retirement, because it seems to me that this is the kind of Sachin Tendulkar show that has been stage managed by him to give him his 200th test in his home stadium, and that actually any consideration for whether it's a good thing for the team has gone completely out of the window. I thought it was amusing the fact that when he announced his retirement, you know, suddenly there came out this message that it had to be in Mumbai, and then the BCCI had to kind of scrabble around and try and make sure that the venue was available and that they could actually play it there for this West Indies match. And the thing that makes me uncomfortable about this whole thing both from the perspective of Indian cricket, but also actually from Tendulkar's perspective, is the stage managing of it. Because actually, if ultimately he gets, you know, he gets a pair in the first test, and then he gets, you know, he gets a couple of scores in the tens in the second test, he is going to look very, very silly having organised this farewell, which is supposed to be spectacular.
I don't disagree with stage managed. I mean, I think it's entirely stage managed. I think he's far too clever a guy, and he has far too much of a love of cricket for not to have seen the significance of completing 200 tests and retiring. And I think he's fully aware of that. The one thing I will say is that there's been an ongoing argument that he's kind of carried on too long and that he's done the team harm through carrying on long through a poor period of form. And it has been poor. An average of just 24 during 2012, an average of just 32 so far in 2013, not a single 100 since Jan 2011. But I think it's worth remembering that he was a player who has often in his career gone through difficult periods and come out brilliantly on the other side.
Do we have the stats to see whether he's gone through a period that's been that bad and come out the other side?
Early on in his career, he came through some periods that were comparably lean.
Yeah, fine. Fine early on, so that you know that you then, if they come through, you have another 10 years to get out of them. But actually, at this stage in your career, you know, he hasn't scored a Test 100 for the best part of 3 years. No one in a batting lineup with the same quality as India's, or even slightly worse than the quality of India's, would actually survive in their batting lineup, simply not making runs.
I guess what it comes down to motive is what has kept him hanging on. And my thought on this is that he is someone who genuinely loves the game. And I saw his kind of slightly heartfelt interview when he announced his retirement, and he was talking about, you know, how he almost doesn't know what he's going to do next, and cricket's been his life, etc. And I felt like he had to prove to himself that he had nothing more to give. And I think now he has. I think he's proven to himself that he is in a sort of irreversible decline and that this is it. I think it's very difficult to balance that with, he is a great player who's achieved all this so much. He has to prove this to himself. In the process of proving that, does he harm Indian cricket?
One of the questions that I think is really interesting that it hasn't been at all asked over the last, you know, 3 or 4 weeks or whatever it is since he retired, 2 or 3 weeks, has been who is going to replace him at number four for India. Because actually, number four is the pivotal position. Number four is where you put your best batsman, give or take, unless they're a specialist opener, say. And as far as I can tell, all of the media attention has been focused on Sachin rather than on India and the impact it's going to have on India. I realise that I'm kind of sounding as if I have a bit of a kind of anti-Sachin, you know, vendetta here, and I don't.
That,
as well. I mean, I think
to
it's
be
brilliant,
fair,
but
it's not his fault though.
No, it's not his fault. And he obviously is. He has to stage manage because inevitably, whatever happened, it was going to create enormous publicity. But it just seems to me that the whole thing has been dislocated from how the Indian team needs to develop, actually. I agree that there's this question of what his impact on the team is beyond his runs, and that there must be a lot of, you know, impact simply of having someone who's that brilliant a cricketer and that brilliant a cricket brain.
It's why I'd love to know what Dhoni makes of the whole thing. I mean, has Dhoni appreciated having him around? Would he almost have had him gone earlier? I think there's a very interesting, I tried to avoid doing this on the podcast, but I'm going to do it anyway. Very interesting footballing parallel with this. When a few years ago, Arsenal got rid of Thierry Henry, their flagship player. And there was a sense that in the immediate aftermath of it, there was almost a lot of relief in the dressing room. Because actually, he had grown too big. He was sort of bigger than the club. And in the case of Tendulkar, you've got a man who's possibly bigger than the country. And I almost wonder whether...
But it can take pressure off, actually. I think, you know, if Tendulkar fails, everyone's talking about Tendulkar failing. If Virat Kohli goes out and fails, it's kind of, absolutely, people notice, and he's a brilliant batsman. But it's not quite the same as if you have someone like Tendulkar.
I think either way, it will be very interesting to see how this young Indian batting lineup responds, because they are going to, in some sense, they're going to be greater focus, because there's going to be almost like, well, who's the new Sachin? You know, who's the new, you know, number one player? But at the same time, maybe as a whole, with him out the way, they'll actually be able to find their own identities a bit more and kind of relax a bit. I think it will be very interesting to see how they respond. I think also, an intriguing situation for the West Indies, who are almost, I mean, if we take this example of, you know, this metaphor of stage managed.
If Tendulkar is on 99 in a winning cause, with 5 runs left to get, he skies a catch. for a century in his last Test innings. It'll be a big decision for whoever's under it.
Well, look, I'm not in any way anti-Sachin, but I think it's the West Indies' obligation to go there and try and spoil the party. Yeah, I mean, that's entirely their aim, and it would be entirely wrong of them. No, I hate to say it, I fear they may just get swept up in the whole thing, actually.
I'm not sure really what we can add to the debate really that's going on throughout the cricketing world about Sachin Tendulkar's retirement, because it is obviously the big news and it's going to be dominating the news for a while to come. But I think one thing is for certain, that it is a phenomenon that A, we're not going to see the like of very much, but B, that it's very, very difficult to handle so that everyone comes out winners one way or other. I mean, we've talked about the West Indies, we've talked about the Indies team, we've talked about Sachin Tendulkar, and ultimately, I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if somewhere along the way over the next few months one of those three ends up in a sort of tricky position out of it all.
I wonder if we as English cricket fans almost just don't quite get it. Like, I almost don't think we understand the reverence and euphoria that this man generates, and I almost wonder whether it's something that has to be solved in a way that keeps Indian fans happy. I almost feel that's a key part of this.
I was at Andrew Caddick's last test, so I think I can empathise.